I'm Marie Bernard, host of Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Join me Mondays at noon as we explore the universal energy that connects us all. Let's discuss our journey of self-discovery, joy, presence, and living with authenticity. We can create positive change in the world, and it starts within each one of us. Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. Mondays at noon on CITR 101.9 FM, Vancouver.
Hello, good afternoon. Welcome to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. I'm your host, Marie Bernard, and it is a beautiful day in Vancouver. I'm super excited. I always say I'm super excited, but I'm really enthusiastically excited today about our guest, Dr. Stan Tatkin. He's been on the show before, and he is the author of Wired for Love, Your Brain on Love, and Love and War in Intimate Relationships. And he's also working on a dating book right now. And he has a clinical practice in Southern California. He teaches at Kaiser Permanente, and he's an assistant clinical professor at UCLA. And he also developed the psychobiological approach to couple therapy together with his wife. They founded the Pact Institute, and we're going to be talking about his couple therapy, what is a psychobiological approach to that. And if you have a question and you want to get on the air and ask it, the number is 604-822-2487. Welcome to the show, Stan.
Hi, Marie. How are you?
I am wonderful. I'm so happy that it all worked out.
I am too. I'm very happy. Yeah.
Yay.
And I'm glad you have good weather there.
Yes. Yes. It's been really nice. We're really lucky. So maybe for people who haven't heard your previous interview, just for our education, could you tell us a little bit about what it means to a psychobiological approach to couple therapy?
Yeah, it's a mouthful, isn't it? What psychobiology means basically is that we're looking at the whole person developmentally, brain development, nervous system development, and from a psychological point of view. So it really combines more than just psychology. We're looking at faces, eyes, movement, skin color, voice, all that stuff. Basically observing the human animal.
Awesome.
If that makes sense.
It does. And I've listened to Wired for Love, and I've read Your Brain on Love, or is it the opposite? The book?
They all seem to have brain in them. Yeah. Love and War, Wired for Love, and Your Brain on Love, yeah.
Yes. So I've read and listened to two of those. I haven't read Love and War yet, but I'll have to pick that one up as well. And so I'm curious about how the approach to therapy works. So what does it look like if a couple goes into your office for this type of therapy for the first time?
Well, with me in particular, people, the first time we meet for 3 hours, we're all on chairs that wheel, not on stationary furniture. I use videotape because a lot of this research involves what's called a frame analysis, where we're looking frame by frame at people's behavior, faces, and so on. And a lot of this is played back to the couple, not all of it, but some is played back. And so were you saying something? Did I interrupt you?
No.
Okay, I thought I heard. And so we work basically by listening to what people are saying, but we're more interested in what people are doing, what their bodies are doing. And the reason we do that is because as PACT therapists, we understand how the brain works and how processing of information works. And that is that we react and act by memory on a somatic level, on a body level, and that really is more that expresses more of the truth than words do. Talk, we don't put as much stock into.
Interesting.
The narrative, yeah.
So the first session is 3 hours, which is unlike a normal therapy session. It's a little bit different.
It's different because it takes time for people to settle in. It takes time also to get into trouble in a therapy session, and also to get out of trouble in time to, you know, to leave right side up. So the sessions tend to be very intense, but very playful and very with a lot of variety in it. And the time flies very fast, but as PACT therapists, we're trained to get information faster than most approaches. and we get information often in ways that that the couple doesn't know that we're getting.
So, Dr. Tatkin, when you say the couples get into trouble, I'm wondering, do you intentionally trigger them so that they have a reaction?
Sometimes, yeah. Sometimes because one of the goals in PACT is we want people to feel absolutely safe and secure in their relationship. We want them to be able to fight about anything without fear of becoming predatory or threatened, you know, to the degree where they become dysregulated. So we want people to have confidence outside of the session. And the only way we can do that is to workshop it in the session.
Because I imagine a lot of times maybe people go to therapy and they're like on their best behavior, and then you don't see what really comes up.
Well, we do, because people can be on their best behavior for 1 hour, hour and a half it's harder, 2 hours very hard, 3 hours impossible. And so people just, you know, it becomes more of a natural situation. When we spend more time together, people loosen up and we start to see what people are really up to. One of the things that the PACT therapists look for right away is, who are these people? What do they really want, and what are they up to in therapy? Mm-hmm. And we have ways of getting that information very early.
Awesome. Well, I have so many questions for you today. Hopefully we'll be able to get through the majority of them. But one listener asked, how many hours of therapy and working on this psychobiological approach would it take to actually notice a difference in your relationship?
People notice it after the first session. And that's because we're working differently. This is a capacity model, not a conflict model. So we're looking at not so much money, time, mess, sex, and kids, which is basically what people fight about. We're looking at the social and emotional capacity and the speed at which people process information and solve problems. That is really the heart of the matter. And so we're observing how good people are in this area. And it is, you know, love actually requires more resources than work. And so if there are deficits or things that people aren't as good at, that's going to show up in the love situation. So changes happen very, very quickly. And the way we approach couple therapy is much similar to family medicine, in that people come in and we deal with a problem, a crisis, a problem that is there. We deal with that, then they leave. And then we want to see them back maybe in a month or a half a year. And so there's no termination process. In PACT, it's an ongoing process where people come in as needed.
Hmm. And so it sounds like after listening to Wired for Love, you talk about, you just mentioned processing speeds and deficits, and then there's different attachment styles as well. So it sounds like what you're doing is training the couple to be able to recognize those signs that their partner is starting to get triggered.
Right. We're training or retraining or teaching people to pay attention and to be present. And that means that they're face-to-face, eye-to-eye, which is why we use the chairs on wheels instead of a couch. So basically, we're engendering love, feelings of love, because love is experienced through eye-gazing and being physically close. So in that way, we're doing what people did probably in the courtship phase of their relationship, but probably stopped doing it. And we're getting them to start to pay attention to not themselves so much, but to start to notice their partner. We want people to be good caregivers of each other and to be experts on each other. And most people coming to therapy are not.
I'm curious.
They're good at. It's interesting. People think about being very good at their work, but they don't think that it's even more important to be good at one's partner. For some reason, that is not in the main consciousness. People just take it for granted and assume that these things take care of themselves. They don't.
Well, we spoke in our previous interview about, and you mentioned this throughout your book as well, is the idea that people in our society tend to have the belief that we are responsible for our own self-love.
Right.
And that's not that it's not true, but it's also in order to have an effective, healthy relationship, we also want to be responsible for our partner at some level.
Yeah, in most other areas, people are pretty much on the nose with regard to how relationships should work. Where people misunderstand, and because it actually is because of the culture they come from and their family, is that in love relationships, it's more efficient to care for, regulate the other person than to regulate the self. So we still have it in our culture from the 70s and the 80s that, you know, you take care of you, I take care of me, and if we should meet in the middle, then fine. That's, you know, it's, or that nobody can love me until I love myself. These are ideas that are still out there, and they're actually untrue. You know, if you study babies, study the human animal, we don't do anything by ourselves without another person having taught it or interacting with us first. So we learn to love ourselves through loving another. They're hand in hand. And so, you know, we have some ideas floating around in the culture that are counter to good, secure, long-lasting relationship. And PACT, we strive to alter that, change that.
Hmm. So I'm curious, Dr. Takin, what about people who maybe don't have a lot of supports in their lives? They're not around a lot of people. Most of their friends are just acquaintances and they don't have a partner. Is there anything that they can do to kind of generate something similar to what they might have with a partner as far as love?
Well, you know, PACT centers around the idea that secure functioning is not only important for couples, but it's important for the world. That secure functioning is it means that two people, let's say, are in an arrangement that's truly mutual and that's based on fairness, justice, and sensitivity. And so we advocate secure functioning even if it's not a romantic relationship. You needn't be in a romantic relationship. This is good friendship. This is being in the foxhole together. This is also a wise thing to do because two people can protect each other from the environment better than one. So, but this is an attitudinal thing. People have to have the right attitude, and that is that that we agree, you and I, to have each other's backs. We agree to do things for each other that nobody else is willing to do because we can and because the alternative isn't that good. We're on our own. We're exposed to the environment, which is hostile, and also to the slings and arrows of life, which are anxiety-producing. So to be tethered together, you and I, to make agreements that protect each other's interests, where we, you know, like I said, we're in the foxhole together, takes certain existential fears off the table and allows us to sleep better at night, wake up refreshed, and to have energy to do other things in life. So it's just smart. It's smart social, you know, contract here talking about. Did I answer your question?
I believe so. Yeah, it kind of leads into another question because my understanding of the attachment types, the island, the anchor is the secure functioning, more balanced.
Actually, the anchor is born secure, and okay. that just means that. In the family culture, relationships came first, and the relationships were based more on principles of fairness and justice and sensitivity most of the time. And then you have everything that's not that, you know, to a greater or lesser degree.
Okay. And then the island is the more detached, super independent. The wave is the more clingy type.
Yes.
And
again, these are all normal. They're normal adaptations to the environment, and the environment is the family in which we're born.
Okay, so it's my understanding that after a while of being in making that conscious effort to be in a secure functioning relationship, that changes occur in the brain where both people will become more naturally anchors. Is that correct?
Yes. And they can be, you know, they can be insecure as individuals. They can be, one person could be an island, which is to say that person operates in a way that fears loss of independence and loss of self. And that can be with somebody who's a wave, which means that person fears abandonment and rejection and punishment. They can be together and craft an agreement that holds the two of them together and protects each other, which makes the relationship secure functioning, even though they are, in fact, insecure as individuals. That's why we're saying that any couple can be secure functioning, and we can prove it. We have people from all areas of life, street people, mentally ill people, people with brain damage, people with personality disorders, they're able to forge secure functioning relationships.
Okay, so that brings up, I'm curious if you could go to PACT therapy with, say, a friend or with someone who, like, let's say it's not a permanent relationship. If that relationship ends, are you just back to square one, wave island, messed up again?
Well, there were two questions, and I think, can people come to PACT therapy as friends? Yes. Business partners? Yes. As father, son? Yes. Or as a family, for that matter. We're really talking about the attitude of the relationship and whether the people in the relationship are protected by virtue of their agreement or a set of agreements to do that, and that goes beyond personality. It goes beyond feeling. But you have your question seemed to have another part to it. And that is, if the relationship ends, are you back to square one?
Yeah.
No, because I think that we learn, don't we? We learn from every relationship, hopefully, that we've been in, and we take our mistakes, if there are mistakes, and we learn not to do those again in the next round. But the important thing is not that the relationship lasts, but that the relationship is secure functioning and that people are thriving in the relationship. We have a concern, you know, in the world about alienation, people being cut off. It doesn't mean they have to be in a partnership, but it does mean that people have to have a social network of some kind. Otherwise, we know that humans and primates get sick. We get sick when we're not connected to others. There's more mental illness. We die earlier. We have more physical ailments. But just being with another person is not an assurance of health. That relationship, again, has to be secure functioning, because we can get sick in a bad relationship, too.
All right. Well, it is time for a break. We are speaking with Dr. Stan Tatkin. You can find him at stantatkin.com. He is the author of Wired for Love, Your Brain on Love, and Love and War in Intimate Relationships, and he also is the founder of the PACT Institute, which is a psychobiological approach to couple therapy. And this is CITR 101.9 FM in Vancouver, or you might be listening online at CITR.ca, cosmicdimensions.com, empowerradio.com, or on the Co-Creator Network, or you might also be watching this on my channel on YouTube, youtube.com/spiritualshow. Wherever you're listening from, thank you so much for being with us, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Get ready for the 2015 Metro Vancouver Transportation and Transit Plebiscite. You must be on the provincial voters list to get a vote-by-mail voting package. Register to vote, or make sure your voter registration is up to date now at elections.bc.ca/OVR or call 1-800-661-8683. That's 1-800-661-8683. This message is brought to you by Elections BC.
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
Hey there, listeners. Every year, Fund Drive, CITR's annual fundraiser, helps raise money to keep CITR running. Last year, we raised over $35,000 to assist our move to a new station. This year, Fund Drive is kicking off February 26th with a party at UBC's Pitt Pub and finishing off with a party at Pat's Pub on March 6th. So let's get digital.
We'll be right back.
This year, our goal is to raise $40,000 to build a new website, digitize our analog archives, make decades worth of CITR history accessible, and more. Starting February 26th, you can call in to pledge towards this year's fund drive. Or starting February 16th, donate online at www.citr.ca. Receive great prizes for your donations. Again, fund drive is this February 26th to March 6th. Help keep campus and community radio healthy. Donate to support CITR.
There's only one way that old clunker is going to make you feel good again. Donate it to Bullying Canada. Check this out. Free towing or pickup of your old vehicle, a tax-deductible receipt, and a super easy process. Online at bullyingcanada.ca. Get rid of that old vehicle and feel good about supporting real solutions for change in your community. Donate your old or used vehicle to Bullying Canada today. Full details online at bullyingcanada.ca.
Are You Aware Radio, alternate Thursdays 6 to 7 p.m. at CITR 101.9 FM. Profiling music and musicians take the route of positive action over apathy.
Welcome back to Synchronicity, talk radio for your mind, body, and soul. We're speaking with Dr. Stan Tatkin. He is the founder of the PACT Institute. StanTatkin.com is where you can find him. And we were talking about secure functioning relationships and how really it would be wonderful if all of our interactions were secure functioning and mutually beneficial, correct?
Yeah, it would be.
Wouldn't that be
nice? Life would be a little easier.
It sure would. I wanted to talk to you about, because one of the main things about the psychobiological approach is that you're able to make eye contact, you're able to see the person's physiology changing in front of you.
Yes.
So, with telephone, at least you can hear voice tones. You pick up some information there. But a lot, we're moving towards email, text communication. And I have experienced for myself that this causes a lot of conflict, unnecessary conflict.
Right.
How have you been noticing this with your clients?
Well, there's a lot of really good things about social media and the way people are communicating. In one sense, people feel like they're tied in, together more than perhaps before, because of all these different ways of connecting with others, even if some of those ways seem to be not as real. But the face-to-face, eye-to-eye contact is really important for interactive regulation. And that is because we're visual animals. Our brain is visually oriented. It used to be a smell brain, but it's a visual brain today. And so at the top of our influence is touch, and then vision, and then sound. So we can get into trouble, you and I, on the phone by misreading each other's intentions because we can't see each other's faces. Even worse than that, texting, we can't hear voice. So if people are bad at this, they're going to be even worse. If they're bad at mutually regulating each other face-to-face, eye-to-eye, they're going to be horrible probably with text, although there are some exceptions. Some people are actually better there and terrible face-to-face, but, that's usually not the case.
Well, one of the things... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
Well, we also warn people about talking about important matters while driving in the car because they're facing forward and one person is using resources to drive. And that is an area where people can get into fights very, very easily because, again, of the way the brain operates and the way the eyes are built. If you're going to deal with anything that's emotionally intense, you're better off pulling over to the side and facing each other and then driving later.
Well, and one of the things I notice about the phone, and I find that the more emotionally triggered you are, the harder it is to think about, okay, let's take a step back, let's talk about this.
That's
when
right.
We can be in person. So I feel like, oh, we have to deal with this right now. And so we might have a conversation over the phone. And the problem with that is, even if you're trying, if your partner needs soothing or you need soothing, the only resource you have is your tone of voice and your words.
That's right.
You can't touch them.
No, you can't touch them. But a skill set for remaining in what Stephen Porges calls social engagement is the ability to modulate one's voice and the sing-songiness. It's called prosody. And so we can regulate each other on the phone as long as we're good at changing our tone and knowing how to be friendly. Because the problem is that when you or I start to feel frightened or scared or threatened, we get into a state of mind where we can no longer think properly, and we operate by memory totally, 100% memory. So there's nothing there to create something new or be novel because we're in a threat state. So the ability to be friendly under those conditions, for me to change you, to say something that is loving or friendly, or to change my voice to a friendly tone, can mean the difference between a huge fight and something that fizzles out, and now we can talk about something. So I have to know how to calm you down so you can think. You have to know how you can calm me down so I can think. Otherwise, we're just going to react from a very automatic place, which is normal. And then we shoot first and ask questions later, and then have to clean it up afterwards.
Mm-hmm. Well, I had something happen with a guy I was dating over the weekend, and Ooh. Over instant messaging.
Oh.
And I am so, I mean, I'm just, I should have known better. But once it kind of started, it was the train, just there were no brakes. And
Aww.
I was like, I can't do this anymore. I basically broke up with him by instant message because he doesn't like the phone. So I
right.
was like, do you want to talk about this in person? Do you want to? And it was just sort of like, that wasn't happening. And so I'm kind of going blah, 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 blah. And he said, he typed, I'm covering my face so I don't have to see what you say. And I should have seen that as a sign of like what you teach, like, shut up now, you're making it worse. And I didn't. And I just was like, I can't. And I was trying to explain why, but it was just making it worse and worse. And then there's all these sunken costs and you're just trying to make it better. And oh my gosh, what a mess. I'm so, and I thought he was mad. I was like, I understand you're pissed. And he's like, no, I'm hurt. And I was like, oh no. And there's no voice tone, and
right.
Oh my gosh, I have no idea how badly I've hurt him because I can't see or speak to him, but I can only imagine.
And that's the problem, and it speaks to you. And I'm so sorry that happened to you. It's happened so often with people. This thing you're talking about. The reason we need to be in each other's eyes, and there's a very good reason for it, is because when we are in each other's eyes, we're brought to the present moment. We're in the present. We're forced to be here. And because real time is extremely fast and people are very complicated, that I have to see what's going on in your nervous system in order for me to respond properly. Otherwise, if I'm in my head, if I'm not looking at you, then I'm thinking about something or I'm seeing a picture of you in some static way, and now I'm going to make all these mistakes, because I have nothing else to go on except my own imagination and my memory. And those are two things that we don't want to happen when people are in distress. Now, if you're feeling great about each other, your imagination, your memory, it comes in handy. But if you're in distress, you're going to start to anticipate wrong things based on your history, and you're going to make moves impulsively that are going to be threatening, and it becomes, like you said, a catastrophe. People need to actually be in each other's eyes to be in the moment and to see what's in front of them and not what's in their head. And unfortunately, when you do texting or anything like that, you have nothing else but what's in your head. So it's a painful, painful experience to not know how you're affecting somebody or what their face is doing and how to fix it. And it sounds like that's the experience you had.
Yeah. And then there's also the way, like, I can't control how they're interpreting what I write because of the lack of voice tone and all of that. So, and then I'm, you know, I mean, I thought he was angry. So I'm responding. I mean, I wasn't in an attacking mode, but I also am a quick processor. I don't know him well enough to know how quickly he processes, but I'm typing very quickly and I'm getting back like one line responses because he's not as fast a typer. And I mean, it was, oh my gosh. And I'm just, I could cry just thinking about it.
I feel
I'm deeply hurt too, but I just feel so guilty because I can only imagine how hurt he is. And I feel like I should know better, but I did it anyway because I was caught up in the moment.
Is there no way you guys can Skype or do something? I imagine you guys are not in the same location, which is why you're texting. Yeah.
Well, we're in the same general vicinity, but not, we weren't in the same room, which would have been nice. And now we're not speaking to each other because, so I hope we can fix it just as far as like healing the moment. Whether we stay friends or not, it would be nice to just be able to make amends for that. But anyway, so it brings up another question about what do you do when, especially because this person is fairly quite a bit younger than me. And so that it's almost like a totally different generation because younger people are so accustomed to text messaging and Facebook and all of that. That how do you kind of get someone on board to do this face-to-face or at least telephone communication if they don't like it?
Well, I think that that would be a deal breaker, that if somebody can't do that, if somebody's not going to do face-to-face, I would imagine that should rule them out as a potential mate because that can't work. It just can't. So, you know, in the old days, people wrote letters and it took months to get to the other person. But that slowed communication down to a degree to where people could actually think about what they say. But now it's so easy to write everything so fast. People are sloppy in their communication. The communication goes too fast. It spins out of control. And you really do need to be in person. So I would say if you're, you know, going with somebody and they refuse to meet and all they want to do is be on text, that's not going to turn out well, as far as I can imagine. So, you know, these things of texting are supposed to be, you know, supposed to augment a relationship that's already going well so that you and I text each other's faces or tell each other how much we love each other or how, you know, that I had this experience today or that experience, you know, but as a soul, as a meal or as a way to connect and stay connected, I think it's a very poor way, again, understanding how our brain operates. It just can't work. We're not built that way. But there are people who are so afraid of being in person. They experience so much interpersonal stress that for them, the only way actually to reach out and to connect with others is through this medium. And that's fine. But I don't know that you have to marry those people.
Mm. Yeah, I dated a guy once who would not speak very much when we were in person, and he was super nervous and anxious, like I could just tell. And but then he would give me a card with this beautiful words of how much I meant to him and all of that. And it was just so weird that because, I mean, it was nice to read, but it would feel so much more impactful to have eye contact and hear those words.
There are people who communicate in different ways. Some people are really good at speech. Like you're a talker, right? This is who you are. You're verbal. There are other people who communicate nonverbally and were trained that way in early childhood, and they could get better, but they don't get better if they're with a partner that that feels threatened. And the problem with people who aren't talking, and if this person also was not very expressive in the face, is that it leaves the other person to wonder what they're thinking and what they're up to. And unfortunately, we have brains that tend to, in a vacuum, we tend to think the worst, not the best. We tend to think negatively. And so this is a problem for people who are shy and not verbal, is that other people tend to imagine who they are because they're not offering enough signal to the outside world, and that's a problem for that person. But if you wanted to be with that person, you'd have to find ways of reading him nonverbally, and maybe he'll get better at it. But it sounds like he really liked you.
Aw, he did. Yeah. He's probably married to someone else now. So last time on the show, I said, you know, I feel like I'm an anchor and with wave tendencies. But since then, I really think that I would like to be an anchor. But I honestly, like you even mention in Wired for Love and Your Brain on Love that waves tend to actually think that they're really good at relationships.
Yeah, they do. And one of the reasons they do, just like islands think they're good at independence, and they're not. They think they're independent, but their independence came by way of neglect. So if you come from a family that that sneers or looks down on dependency, then, of course, you're going to be independent and you're not going to admit that you need anything. But waves were brought up many times being caregivers and having to take care of at least one parent in the family. And so their social skills are such that they are actually more related than the island. They are better at relationships, but they're not as good as they think. And that can be proven, you know. But we have our ideas about ourselves, right? And so we carry those ideas and then we find out you know, that in real time, you know, maybe you know, some of this is inflated, you know.
Yeah, because I view myself as a good communicator, very compassionate and empathic, and that is true. But when I get emotionally triggered, I mean, I just railroaded this poor man, you know, and.
Well, you know what? He should learn to type faster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Don't blame him.
You know, dude, learn to type faster. But you know, it's very funny you mentioned it, Marie. Just as a digress a second, him typing slow and you typing fast. There are people who we call them hares, you know, like rabbit hares, where they're very fast processors in a social emotional, tug of war. They're good. They're fast. It doesn't mean they're right, but they're just fast. And there are people who are tortoises. These are very smart people, some really, really smart people. But in the social-emotional area, they're slow, and they're just not as quick. And oftentimes, they find themselves against the ropes. And maybe this guy isn't just a slow typer, like you said. Maybe he's a slow processor. And that, for that person, they could feel bullied, even though they're not being bullied, but they could feel it because they're just not as quick. So it's interesting you brought that up, by the way.
Yeah, of course it would never be my intention to hurt anyone
right.
or bully anyone. But when you're caught up in the moment and you're just spewing it out and you can't see their reaction, you can't see the pain on their face, and you think maybe they're angry and you're up in your head,
yeah.
right? You're up in your head defending yourself, defending your position, and it just happens so quickly and then... Wow.
So here's the example. So let's say all things being equal, you did or do the same thing. You know, it's not so much whether you are a wave or an anchor, it doesn't matter. It's whether your partner, the person who's with you, knows how to handle you in a good way, knows how to deal with you, knows how to calm you, knows how to relieve you and particularly your fears and concerns. So this person, you know, is not able to do that. And you know, we might also say that the texting probably is not the best way anyway. But likely this person is not able to do that. So I want listeners to understand that it doesn't matter whether you are a cat or a dog. Cats and dogs can get along fine together. They just have to understand that they're cats and dogs, and not expect otherwise, and that they know how to handle the other. Does that make sense?
Yes, and I'm also curious about, with the waves and the anchors, does introversion or extroversion have anything to do with that?
It bleeds in a little bit. For instance, people who are introverts are more likely to be islands, just because of the way the island, their developmental trajectory, what they experience early in childhood and how they process information, tends to be more in line with people who are shy and introverted, but not always. And people who are waves tend to be a little bit more socially engaged and tend to be a little more extroverted, but not always. So I don't want people to take these and use them as hard and fast rules, because people are always more complicated than any idea that's out there. But I think it's safe to say that if somebody is not a big talker, if somebody is shy, if somebody is introverted, those are island-like qualities, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're an island.
Okay. Well, so how have this thing all started? And am I talking too much about this? I like talking about things.
No,
like
I'm
context.
Having fun.
Okay, good. So how this all started is he had texted me and hadn't talked to him for a couple of days. So I wanted to connect and we were both home. And so I said, hey, feel free to give me a call tonight at some point. And he texted, maybe I'm messing around with something. And I'm no voice or anything. I interpret that with me needing to connect. I interpret that as maybe I'll call you, but this thing is more important than you. So, and this is a new relationship. So I messaged him back and I said, clearly I need more attention than you have time to provide. So See ya. Right. And Then there was sort of back and forth. Anyway, ended up calling me, but, then it happened again, and I ended up just saying, look, I can't do this anymore. But the conversation that we had, he was like, look, I'm really introverted, and I need a lot of space. And I said, I can totally respect that. And I actually said, I'm pretty high maintenance. I like a lot of attention. And if that's hard for you, then perhaps we're just not a match. And his attitude seemed to be, I'm going to be my introverted self. I'm going to take all the space that I need. I still want to be with you, but you should just deal with it. At least that's how I interpreted it. So I'm curious, from a relating standpoint, how important is it to have a compatible desire for interaction?
People can be exactly who they are and then understand the benefit of being in a relationship that is secure. However, insecures tend to come to the table with an attitude that is not mutual. In other words, insecures, people who come from insecure backgrounds, tend to come from a one-person system where it has to be good for me, but it doesn't have, if it's not good for you, sorry about that. And so if people are going to want to be feeling safe and secure in a relationship and be who they are, they can, but they do have to take responsibility for their impulses and reflexes. So as an island, let's say, I do like my space and I am introverted, but I want to be with you. And so I understand who you are and I understand how to talk to you and how not to make you feel endangered or abandoned. And I'm able to also be who I am. So for someone like that, the problem is how do I be myself in a relationship? I need relationship, but when I get into one, I'm endangered in some fashion. And so I stay away or I stay out. You would need somebody. He could be just like this guy, but he would understand his tendencies because maybe he's already been through this, many times. He's tired of it, and he really wants to be in a good relationship, so he reins his tendencies in from time to time and also takes the time to understand you, but he's apparently not doing that.
No.
So you both have to understand who the other person is and know how to approach, how to deal with that person so as not to activate their worst fear, you see. You come to the table with a set of fears based on experience, and so does he. And you're both sweeping each other for signs that this is going to happen again, right? You're going to be hurt again. He's going to be hurt again. And your jobs are to allay each other's fears on this matter. But it's too easy to alarm one another, right? And so that's what happened. Let me ask you something. Have you guys met face-to-face yet?
Oh, yeah. We've spent time. Oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. No, we met before we started dating, and it's just all.
Okay.
But the thing is, I'm also balancing, like, I accept that I am fairly high needs as far as, like, attention. I'm fully admit that I'm high maintenance, and I want to be, I don't want to smother anyone, but I also, if I'm going to be constantly feeling abandoned, that's not good for anybody. So how do you balance respecting someone? Like, I had waited 2 days. I didn't contact him. I let him come to me. So then when I offered the phone call and I was rejected, it was like a knife to my heart. Even though I knew intellectually he would never want to hurt me. Like, I know how much he likes me. But I couldn't help but take that personally. So how do you balance, like, being someone who likes a lot of space, someone who's a wave, giving that island their space without feeling rejected or abandoned?
Right. Okay, so let's take it out of the human part, which is sometimes hard to do, and imagine that you're dealing with an animal, and you know this is an animal that doesn't lick like you, doesn't bark like you, doesn't do those things, but they respond to this or that kind of cue. And the way to get them to do things is you have to approach them a little differently than you would, say, another animal. The way to deal with someone like that is to not wait on your end, because that makes you more anxious, but to use more of a strategy of catch and release. Come here, give me a kiss, tell me you love me, now you can go. So that the person who is like him doesn't feel that his need for space is going to be challenged and you're going to be angry, which makes him want to distance more. And you don't have to wait for him to come around, which makes you more anxious and angry. So you grab what you want and you let him go. This, you know, calms his fears that that the other person will never understand his need for distance, and that actually is reparative. But he also has to learn how to move toward you, and that moving away activates a threat system for you, and he doesn't understand that. And so the things that people need to do to get along in this way are really quite small, but they have to be the right things, and people often do the wrong things. Just the thing that they think would work for them, but it actually is kryptonite to the other partner. Do you follow what I'm saying?
Yes. Well, the golden rule, treat people how you want to be treated, is usually really wrong, because a lot of people want to be treated completely differently.
They have different brains and they have different experiences and they have different fears. And keep in mind that 99% of our day is automatic. We have a part of our brain that's running our lives 99% of the time, and it's running off of memory. It's not running off of anything to do with consciousness. So, and we need to do that, otherwise we wouldn't be able to exist. So that's good because it's efficient, but that's bad because we make too many mistakes by doing this. And so he's operating by memory when he reacts to you, as do you to him when you see signs of withdrawal that he's not available. And in this way, rather than calming each other, you excite each other's worst fears. And that is something that people can learn to not do. And it makes all the difference in the world, because both of you felt threatened. You felt threatened by his dismissal and lack of availability. He feels threatened by your coming toward him, which to him means something quite dangerous. You're not intending to do this, neither of you are doing it purposely, but it's happening automatically, because neither of you are actually thinking about how the other person operates and not thinking about what you must do in order for you to feel safe. So for you, not waiting is important. I would not wait. You grab your partner, you tell, come here, sit down, stay, and you can go now. So that you're not holding on to them too long. For the island, timing is everything. They're always afraid they're going to be held too long and be trapped. And they have no defense against that other than to flee. And so one way around that is to make sure that they know that it's okay. You have them come to you, and then you can let go of them right away before they need to get out. for the wave, it's important for them to know that when they're negativistic and angry, that their partner isn't going to go away, that they'll move toward them and love them up. It's the opposite of what people think to do intuitively, but that's the repair that's necessary.
Hmm. Well, and I'm wondering if maybe you'll cover this in your book, but you mentioned the catch and release technique, which I like what happened,
right.
What was happening in the beginning was, I mean, and this was very new, like it progressed, it got way too intense too quickly, which is why I ended it. But I was saying to him, well, will you message me tomorrow or message me when you get home? And I was asking him and he would comply and then I would be happy and say, thank you, I appreciate it. But then after the last time I saw him, I said, give me a call sometime soon. And I let him, I wanted to see how long, and maybe this was my mistake, I wanted to see how long it would take him to naturally reach out. And by that time, I felt already deprived.
Yeah, that's a mistake, because I have a feeling you do that, maybe, you wait. And that's a way to see whether the person will come to you. But again, you're picking a cat, and cats don't do that. So so that's bound to make you feel hurt. For all you know, this is somebody who just loses his attention in whatever he's doing and forgets because he does not experience a feeling of being tethered to anybody. So you might feel it's very personal that he doesn't call you, but it's probably not. Just like he may think it's very personal to him when you're angry with him, but it's really not really. So this is how we all tend to not understand each other and how easy it is to do that. People need to understand also that human communication is so incredibly flawed that if people are not very careful to make sure that the other person understands what they're saying, that there are going to be lots of mistakes. People are assuming things all the time. They're taking things for granted. And the more you guys, the two of you, get to know each other, the more you're going to automate each other, and your mistakes are going to increase because you're going to assume you know the other person, and that you know yourself with the other person, and that's probably not really true. It just seems that way.
But okay, so I hear what you're saying about it not being personal, and I do understand that on an intellectual level. But
right,
it doesn't
feel terribly personal.
But it's still my emotions, especially because I'm highly sensitive emotionally. I still feel it, even though my brain is telling me this isn't personal. It's like this battle between my thoughts and my emotions. But then, I mean, all these dating experts say, you know, men like to pursue, you shouldn't. So that's why I'm kind of like, I don't want to be too buggy.
I think it's fine. As adults, be yourself. Contact him when you want to contact him. Because what you're vetting, you're looking for somebody who can tolerate that. Right? Can tolerate you wanting to connect and wanting to contact. Not somebody who you have to worry about and you have to strategize with, right? So I say do that. And by the way, this idea that men need to pursue is not strictly a gender issue. There's a gender overlay with regard to male and female behavior, right? But attachment, there are women who do not like people pursuing them, who are introverted like this gentleman, and they don't want to be contacted. They don't like to be pursued. And men who love that. So I think it has to do more with early experience of attachment and what we fear most if we depend on another person. I fear if I depend on you, you'll reject me or you'll abandon me or I won't be loved or wanted. Or I fear that if I depend on you, I'll lose myself. You'll take all my things. I won't have my independence and I'm trapped. And these are real fears that people have based on real experience, but they're old experience. These are old experiences, and unfortunately, we bring them to the table when we date and we meet another partner. Does that make sense?
It does. And I'm really aware of, we just have a few minutes left in the show before Parts Unknown comes around. So I'm just wondering what you, and thank you so much, Dr. Tatkin, for your time.
And you're not high maintenance, by the way. Everyone's high maintenance. There's this illusion of people being high maintenance. You're high demand. And I think what you want is not somebody who says don't demand so much. You're wanting someone who demands back.
Mm-hmm.
So let's us both be high demand. Let's us both be pain in the butts. Let us both be needy. Fine, that's the quid pro quo. We get to be as needy as we want to be with each other, rather than we can only do that so much. In love relationships, people do best when they're very needy with each other and they make demands on each other. That's the quid pro quo. That's how it evens out.
And I totally, yeah, I want to be that for my partner, but I get, anyway.
Find somebody who wants to do that too.
Yeah. So we'd have just a few minutes left in the show. What would you like to focus on for the last couple of minutes?
Oh, golly, this was so much fun. I wasn't even thinking about that. Gee, I don't know. I wasn't prepared for that. I was so involved in your story.
Well, where if people are interested, first of all, anyone who is a human should read your book and listen to Wired for Love. StanTatkin.com is your website. But if people want to actually see a therapist and do this PACT psychobiological approach to couple therapy, where can they do that? How should they contact you?
They can go to stantakin.com, and there's a link there to our professional site, which is called thepactinstitute.com. And PACT is P-A-C-T, thepactinstitute.com. And that's where people who also want training in this form of therapy, we teach all over the world. We have training programs all over the world. And also a way to find people who to do treatment with. So there's a lot of ways that people can reach out. So either of those sites, info@stantakin.com or info@thepactinstitute.com, all of that will get to the right places.
Awesome. And I know that there are a lot of therapists and coaches who listen to this show. What level of education does one need to become trained to be a PACT therapist?
Well, we accept only people who are licensed or pre-licensed. In other words, they're getting their license. So there's, you know, students, but they're going to get licensed. So we restrict it to those people. Those are, by the way, they can be psychiatric nurses, psychiatrists, physicians, therapists, psychotherapists, social workers, doesn't matter. But we don't let lay people in. They have to be professional and working towards professional licensure and interested in loving also working with couples.
Cool. Well, do you want to tell us a little bit? I don't know how secret it is. I know you're working on this dating book. It's coming out later this year, right?
Well, the last chapter was just submitted, so we're done. It's called Wired for Dating. It's through New Harbinger, and it's due to come out at the end of this year.
Oh, awesome. I'm so excited to read that book. It can't come fast enough for me. I just like...
You're delightful, Marie. You really are.
Oh, thank you. And appreciate... I disagree. I think I'm really freaking high maintenance, but I'm worth it. I'm
so
worth
what?
It.
So worth it.
Oh, Chris says I'm worth it too. Thank you.
You know what? People are just irritating and a pain in the butt. That's just people. And there is no such thing as a low maintenance person up close. Maybe from afar, and maybe if they're in a coma. But no, people are. You know, if they're low maintenance now, they're not going to be very long because people eventually get to be very difficult.
I could find a boyfriend in the coma ward. That is.
There you go, coma.us. You could do a new dating site. You could search the coma word.
That is a novel idea. Well, I really appreciate your time, Dr. Tatkin. Is there anything you want to add before we say goodbye?
No, I adore you.
Aw, I love you too. Thank you so much. You are just, I just really appreciate the work that you do and the impact you're making on the planet. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
All right. Well, have a wonderful day, Dr. Tatkin.
You too.
Take care. So that was Dr. Stan Tatkin. Again, you can find him at stantatkin.com. He is, along with his wife, the founder of the PACT Institute, P-A-C-T. If you are looking for couples therapy, if you want to go with your friend, there are therapists all over the place that are trained in this psychobiological approach to couple therapy. So stantatkin.com is where you can find all the information. And I hope that you have a wonderful day. Chris Arifik is in here. I know he's just dying to shout out namaste. but I want to send you lots and lots of love. Be well. I love you so much.
Namaste.
Namaste.
The hip hop right now, man, as far as the way I see it, I think right now hip hop is advancing as far as skills. You got brothers, you know what I'm saying, getting like more witty.
There ain't nobody to be pretty for. Let it rattle.